The following episode of The Trumpet contains a scene featuring explicit material. The Trumpet is not an explicit podcast, but the scene featured on this episode contains language or situations some may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome to The Trumpet, the official podcast of Elephant Room Productions. I am Robert Gene Pelleccio, your host, and today I am talking with Professor David A. Miller. Thank you for coming on today.
Thank you.
Before we jump into your play and Ears, can you talk a little bit about your theater background and what got you to this point?
Sure. I trained as an actor first, as I think a lot of people do, kind of coming to theater where that was the most visible path. And then in undergrad, I started sort of branching out and wrote my first play and started doing a lot more work working on new plays, both as a playwright and as a director of new plays. And that's where I continued to work. And as I went into grad school at Rutgers for an MFA in directing as well.
Where did you initially study? You said Rutgers was your grad study?
Yeah, my undergrad was at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington, up in the northwest of the northwest.
Ooh. And where did you start kind of your theatrical journey? Did you start as kind of a youth, or did you enter into college with kind of the idea to explore various aspects of theater?
Well, I think I always looked to a couple of things that happened when I was very young, doing Cub Scout skits probably in first and second grade and things like that were probably my first forays into theater, and then doing The Wizard of Oz in fourth grade, and then really got involved in theater in high school, and then really understood that that's what I really love. So I chose my undergraduate program specifically because of the really strong theater program that they had.
I have to ask, who were you in The Wizard of Oz?
I was the wizard in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, the title character.
Yes, yes. It was a fourth and fifth grade play, so I really wanted to play, you know, the probably the scarecrow most of all. But the fifth grade girls got to play the really important roles.
As always.
But I was a fourth grader, and I was able to play the wizard, so I thought that was still pretty great.
That was pretty cool. I was the lion many, many years ago, and like you, I also, for some reason, clung to the scarecrow. I don't know why. Yeah. When you look back on it, the lion is definitely a better role. It's got two songs. It's got, there's a lot more like slapstick. It did not, it wasn't the best memory playing a mattress in the middle of the summer, basically, is what I felt like. I did kind of get to relax for act one, and then the end of act two, or end of act one, I had to put on however many layers that costume was, put on the wig, and I didn't know this until I did the show, but the lion does not leave the stage at all in Act 2, so that made it great for getting water. But no, it's funny, because yeah. I was talking to Lauren in the first episode about how every actor at some point in their career has Peter Pan somewhere along, and Wizard of Oz is another one of those shows that I think everybody is in some way associated with the Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, are you primarily a playwright, director, actor? You said you started with acting and started to branch off once you got to the master's program. But just how many hats would you say you wear, and what is your primary one?
Well, I'm really, I think, a director first and foremost. That's really how I encounter the world. I see it through a director's eyes most of all. And a close second to that is being a playwright. So the third is an educator, director, playwright, educator, and all of those things certainly work together. Like I said, I work a lot on new plays and developing new plays, both as a director and as a playwright and as an educator. So I really love doing all things theatrical and in those different roles. And I also have an interest in visual art as well that I was just talking to a couple of students about. I designed the set for the Scottish play that we did here on campus, and really love working as a graphic designer. So there are many, many hats indeed, and a lot of different aspects of visual arts and performing arts that I really love.
I think that's really interesting because many theatrical professionals who I've worked with or talked to, the story starts out the same way. As you said, they go in as an actor, they go in as some other role in theater, and through some sort of realization or some play, some production, they realize that director or set designer or, you know, whatever else is kind of their calling. But I really love that you have not given up those other hats, that you keep pretty much every aspect of theater that interests you alive, which is definitely something that I love to pursue. I consider myself an actor first, but I love the challenge of a good play to direct. I love working behind the scenes. Pretty much the only area of theater I've not worked in is costume design. But what is it like kind of bouncing back and forth between those different roles?
I think they just really inform each other. And I really, I tend to be really willing to slip from role to role. I had a great experience even a couple of years ago when I was just in the role of playwright, but I had also been serving as the artistic director of the company, and I was usually the director of a lot of the works that these actors were involved in. And it was so funny to see even close friends of mine who had been working with for years, usually directing them, and for them to see me be as quiet as I was in the room as a playwright was fascinating to them. Because obviously as a director, you try to, you know, ask questions and then get out of the way, but you also obviously are very vocal in the room. And as a playwright in a developmental workshop, I wanted to listen as much as possible and take notes and then respond with the next draft of the play. So that's to say, I enjoy switching roles, and I'm able to go into that role in the same way that, for example, if I'm assisting on something, I'm really good at checking myself and making sure that I'm fulfilling my role as the assistant and I'm not leading the room and I'm supporting the leader in that room. So I just enjoy it. I think it gives me different perspective, and it certainly gives me different perspective that I can bring to my students as well as I teach all these different areas. I teach directing and I teach playwriting and I teach acting. So I try to stay active in all three areas so I can best inform my students as well.
So do you think that having kind of an equal level of activity in these different areas helps inform decisions when you have to switch into a different role? Like your work as a playwright, do you think that various things you do with table work and developing characters informs how you would direct a different piece?
Definitely. Yeah, I'm definitely always crossing over, and especially whenever I'm working on a piece, I think the directing especially informs the playwriting, because when I'm looking at the structure of an existing play and working on that, I'm always asking questions in the back of my mind about the clarity in my plays or the lack of clarity that I'm in my plays. What else do I need to be doing to develop them? Definitely, that certainly inform each other.
And how long have you been writing? You said you still kind of consider yourself primarily a director, teacher, but playwriting seems to be really high up there on the list of priorities you have with theater.
Yeah, I really started writing first because I needed to, in order to shape some of the educational work I was doing with young people, working with second and third and fourth graders and helping them to shape plays through their improvisation or through their ideas and exploration and bringing those all together into a cohesive whole, I was really having to be the lead playwright in a way and assembling all of their ideas. And I think that was a really good practice for what I've done since, including sometimes doing pieces that are almost choral poems in a way as well. And then it was not until while I was in grad school that I think I had my, I felt like, I don't know, a real turning point. There was a play that all of a sudden I just felt like I needed to write, called A Lesson in Art. And just in the process of writing that, it was such a satisfying experience. And I was ready to do more, and I basically didn't stop. You know, since then, I regularly have a play or two kind of in the works, whether I'm physically sitting down and writing it or not, or if I'm just having ideas about it.
You're reminding me of a document that has been saved on my computer for 3 years that keeps beckoning me to finish it, that I swear one day I will.
Sure.
So how many plays have you written in the time that you have been writing?
Boy, I don't know.
What about of just published works?
15 or something.
Oh, geez. That is a lot.
between 10-minute plays and one-act plays and full-length plays.
Well, what genres do you generally write in? Do you generally do more full length, or do you kind of balance it between the 10 minutes and the one acts?
Yeah, I kind of go between the different formats, but I think more often than not these days I'm spending more time certainly working on the full lengths than I have in the past. Yeah.
And what genre do you generally go to? The play we're going to talk about soon, Semi-Permanent, it's kind of like the last play I talked about on this podcast. We definitely found some humor in it, but there is also a very specific subject matter and a very serious subject matter. So do you tend to write more blended drama and comedy, or do you tend to lean towards one or the other?
I think with my full lengths, they tend to have serious themes, but with a lot of humor within the play. Definitely. Some of my shorter plays, some of my 10-minute plays, lean maybe more directly on humor or a comedic idea. But I think the full lengths tend to be more serious, although I've thought about, I appreciate comedy so much. I love directing comedy tremendously, and certainly use a lot of humor in teaching and directing. And I've thought about maybe I should branch out and actually focus on writing a comedy as one of my next plays. We'll see.
Why do the shorter plays tend to end up more on the comedic side?
I don't know. Maybe they're just, a couple of them, like one of them was just a funny idea that I don't think would be able to be sustained. It was almost like more of a, yeah, it was just an idea. It was the hero's journey, or it takes a village to make a sandwich. And it was...
Hold on. I need a little more. It takes a village to make a sandwich.
So basically it's taking Joseph Campbell's hero's journey steps, but putting them into the journey of a young man to get a hoagie from a substore run by Joe C. And it it takes us through the different parts of that. So with that idea, it was kind of a fun, kind of silly idea to create this epic journey of getting yourself a sandwich. It didn't really warrant a full-length play.
Okay, well, you and I need to talk after this podcast about that play, because I need to read it. That sounds amazing. Well, let's move on to Semi-Permanent. We have a scene ready to play to set it up, but before we get there, can you please just give a brief synopsis and brief setup for the concept of the play?
Sure. It really focuses on the role of the younger town, and hometown becomes a very interesting term, I guess, because there's some questions about whether or not she really calls this place home anymore. It's the place that she grew up, but maybe she doesn't really want to be there. But she comes back, especially with an eye for investigation, in a way. One of her best friends, who was a senior in high school that previous spring, she's coming home during the summer, and that spring he killed himself. Which we learned pretty quickly in the play. That loss obviously reverberates throughout the community, and the way that he, or maybe the reasons that he took his own life are examined or brought to light or argued over the course of the play. And this journalistic eye also has some controversial ways of putting that information out in the world kept a secret from her friends. And I guess I shouldn't say much more than that, just in case anybody actually is going to read it or see it. And I don't want to say how it ends. But that's sort of the overview, the big idea of the play.
Definitely. And can you set up this specific scene for me real quick? I believe this is the opening of the play.
Which scene is it?
The opening of the play.
The opening scene where she goes, she comes home and she's at the diner?
Correct.
So, so she's just arrived, and she heads right to the town diner rather than go home directly because, for various reasons that are sort of alluded to, it's not really a happy home, let's say. She stops at the diner and immediately gets in contact with Chris, who is, I hope, a wise person in town who's able to be a sounding board for her, and she's able to land at least for a moment there before she has to encounter the rest of what is her hometown.
All right, thank you so much. Let's take a listen.
Scene one. An empty diner, a front door, a booth. Emma stands just inside the front door, suitcase in hand.
Hello? You still open?
Chris enters wearing a server's apron.
We sure are, Emma Jackman. I am happily surprised to see you.
Hi, Chris. Wasn't sure. Everything in Northampton stays open later.
College town.
Right.
I'm trying to keep us open later. Never know who might come by. And besides, what else am I going to be doing? Sit? Coffee?
Emma sits. Chris grabs coffee, returns to the table with a mug and carafe.
Just arrived?
Yep. I got a ride from the bus station.
How does it feel to be back?
I don't really feel like I've arrived yet. This is a weird place.
Because no one's here. It's 9 p.m. on a Monday.
This town.
Maybe.
And now it's even weirder. Without Gabe.
Yeah. I'm sorry about Gabe.
Me too.
For your sake, too, I mean. I know you two were close.
Yep.
I haven't seen you since Christmas?
I would have come back in April, but...
There was no funeral.
Right. I guess they gave me a gift. I met my deadlines at the paper that week.
Oh, yeah?
I am the assistant opinions editor of the Sophia, the school paper.
Good for you.
I would have rather been at a funeral for Gabe. That sounds odd to say.
I know what you mean.
Thanks.
He was entertaining, that is for sure. My mom loved him like a son, sort of.
What do you mean, sort of?
I mean, she loved him because he flirted with her shamelessly.
Gabe?
Yeah.
Your mom?
Yeah, you never saw that? I mean, it wasn't like they were going to, you know, but he just made her laugh so much, his impressions. I guess that's what you call them?
Yeah, he had a certain dramatic flair.
Yeah, we never understood why he was never in the plays in school.
You saw how Sam was treated.
Teased?
More like bullied or harassed. Kids. Some of the teachers, even.
But Sam?
He's got nerves of steel. When he has a mind to do something, he does it. Do not get on his bad side. But if you're on his good side, you have the greatest ally.
I believe it.
Gabe was just as loyal. But he couldn't find a way to stand up for himself. To other kids, to his parents. He hated confrontation. So he would just avoid the situation altogether, find some way, any way he could to get out of it.
A moment as this sinks in, Emma then fiddles with her coffee mug, briefly makes eye contact with Chris, having a hard time.
More coffee? I'm gonna make you a fresh pot, okay?
Emma nods, Chris exits, Kevin enters.
Hey.
Hey.
They hug awkwardly.
Jimmy Thompson told me you were here.
At the diner?
In town. His dad works at the bus station. Saw you.
I almost forgot how you can't do anything in this town without everyone knowing.
I figured out the diner part. I knew you would need a break before seeing your... before going home.
Yep. How are you feeling these days?
I'm okay.
You're okay. You two were inseparable.
Maybe.
You were best friends.
Emma, you're my best friend.
No, I'm not, Kevin.
You are. Why didn't you call me to tell me you were coming to town?
I didn't want to bother anyone.
I called you. In April.
When Gabe died?
Yeah.
That's completely different.
That's what friends do.
Emma drinks coffee.
How's school?
Good. It's good.
You ended late?
No, we ended in May.
Yeah?
But I had some things to do in Northampton, so I stayed.
Well, at least we got the rest of the summer.
We...
Right? Doesn't school start up again in September?
End of August.
Okay, so end of August.
I'm here for 2 weeks.
You're shitting me.
I have to get back. I'm working for the school paper now, and we have a lot to get ready for the school year. I could show up at the last minute if I really wanted to, but I'm trying to get the opinion section back on track from soft journalism to important social and political issues that face all young women, not just the students at Smith.
Sounds like a waste of time.
Fuck you, Kevin.
I'm sorry, it's just... Why don't you want to have a summer?
It's still summer in Northampton.
I thought you were coming home.
This isn't home for me.
Then what is it?
I don't know. The place where I grew up?
That's home, then.
No. Home is where you go and you have no place else to go. And I have a place to go now. It's my home now. My new home. Maybe my first home. I don't know.
That's fucked up.
No, it's not.
Then why are you here?
I don't understand what happened to Gabe.
I told you. On the phone.
I know what technically happened to Gabe, but I still don't understand why.
Emma, his family?
But he dealt with them. He seemed like...
You could handle it?
Yeah.
Why are we even talking about this? We got a plaque for the snowman, the snow woman.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's not from the Guinness people, since we don't really have the record, but the town council still thought it was important to have a plaque. So it says something like, the tallest snow woman in the world to date, with the date on it. Doesn't mention that someone else built a taller one a few weeks later.
Bethel.
Hmm?
It was Bethel who built the tallest one.
Right. Yeah, it makes it worse, right?
We think they heard of ours, then built another one.
And of course, their town is bigger, so more people and shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's the big news from the small town. Just want to make sure you're all caught up on what happened since you were here for Christmas break. That's it. Hometown pride.
That's not the big news, Kevin. Our friend Gabe killed himself.
Jesus, Emma.
What?
I don't want to...
Why not?
It's not going to change things.
Talking about it?
Why can't we just go back to the way things were? With us. You used to like me.
I still like you, Kevin. But I don't like it when you act like nothing has happened. That nothing has changed. A lot has changed. A lot.
Yeah, stay here. This town is better with you in it, Emma.
Chris returns with coffee and another mug. Pours.
Hey there, Kevin.
Hey, Chris.
Heard you come in. Brought you a mug.
Just leaving.
Okay, then.
See you, Emma.
Kevin exits.
All right, and we're back. So, David, to just start off, what was your intent behind writing this piece?
Well, the idea came about with a couple of things in mind. One is that my colleague and friend J.V. Mercanti and I, who both teach acting at a university level, were thinking about the need for a play to serve our students in which everyone would have a role. We find a lot of times that plays don't necessarily have, a lot of great plays are not necessarily age-specific to college students, with a variety of types of roles for our students. So that was one of the inspirations was, well, what about if we create this play? What if I write a play that he and I could both use in our classes and could also produce this play both at universities and professional theaters? So I started thinking about that as a structure, which is why it has six characters. It has of varying character types and varying gender types, and including one character who is gender flexible casting for that role. And then from there, I was thinking about structure, and then out of that structure made me think of what might be a concern in the world of young people, in the world of the students I teach, in the world of students and or young people around these ages around the country, because the other thing we wanted to make sure it was a universal concern, especially with JV and I being very New York-centric. We didn't want to write a play that could only be done in New York schools or really even having a specifically urban interest that could be done different places. And from there, I just started spinning out into the things that I'm concerned about, including LGBT youth and the challenges that they face, and the challenges that they face especially in those parts of the country where the community is not supportive, is not filled with advocates I'm very lucky in my world to have advocates and allies all around me who are looking out for the young people around me as well, but it's not necessarily true everywhere. So I started examining that and examining that through the play.
And let's talk real quick about the gender flexible character, Chris,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was really interesting because when we did the reading, we had a male actor reading that part. And it's interesting because a good friend of mine has also written a play with a character who is not so much gender flexible, but she had written it with a specific gender in mind, but kind of went back and forth. And I've read for this character before, and by reading for it, I see the character as male, but as she's continued to work on the piece and continue to work through it, she sees the character more as female and is very interested in workshopping it that way. So how did you arrive on the decision to make this character gender flexible? Did you start out with a gender in mind and it just kind of morphed as the piece was written? And did it have something to do with the accessibility of different groups of college students?
Yeah, I think it was certainly partially just structure of making sure that there were enough types of roles for all students to play. And it's something that comes up regularly in my classes as well, even with actors choosing monologues and having those monologues be presented as male monologues or rather monologues for men and monologues for women. And I've had actors say, but well, you know, do I have to be in a traditional category? To which I say, no, you should choose a monologue that best reflects how you identify. And so that was part of the idea of even having actors who then may, you know, be at different places on the gender spectrum and not being binary. And that's what really led me to that, is whatever that might be, it might not be male, it may not be female per se. So that was part of the inspiration. And again, the structure, just making sure that there's enough different types of scenes for different combinations of people.
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge for me too when it comes to approaching roles and approaching monologues. There's one that's kind of been in the back of my mind for a while, very, very funny monologue that is definitely supposed to be a woman, and it is written very feminine, but it's one of those things where you really don't even have to tweak the words. It's just the meaning behind the words changes when it becomes a man. And I think that that's really, I think that that's really great, just in general, the characters that you've created, that it does create that environment. Because I think back to my time at Bloomsburg University, and all of the opportunities when we were in an intermediate or advanced acting class or directing class. And the moment that kind of sticks with me is there was a directing assignment we had to direct Raisin in the Sun scenes. It was a part of the, I think, beginner level director's class. And we were just kind of paired up. It didn't matter race or gender. It was all about, how do you direct a scene? How do you block a scene? But I do remember feeling a little odd playing Walter Lee Younger. But at the same time, you know, the exercise was just to show, you know, how would you stage the scene? What choices would you make to really tell the story? So this play, I think, is really interesting because there isn't a lot of that, just put a person on this side of the stage in this character just so you can show. I feel like this scene, or this play in general, could be dissected, and 9 out of 10 times you would have appropriate casting in addition to the exercise of directing and blocking. And I will say another thing about this play that really struck home with me is I wouldn't say I'm necessarily from a small town. I'm from a suburb. I grew up about half hour away from Philadelphia. So a lot of this play really struck home with me. I've not lived at home for a few years now, but when I was in college, and especially after the first year of college, coming home, catching up with old friends, going to the typical spots. We didn't have a cafe per se. I can plug Ray's Diner, which is no longer in Narstown, but that was kind of my cafe from this play. We would always go there at 2 a.m. and get either pancakes or a tuna melt or whatever. So I thought it was really interesting to kind of tap back into that those years of my life where I was growing up and moving on and all this, but all of this stuff remained with me at home.
Yeah.
Were there any similar experiences in your town, your home life, that kind of shaped the town, or was this more of like an everyman situation where this is the quintessential coming home story?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, certainly, I don't know, I think for anybody, especially going off to college or going off to live anywhere else and coming back, home changes. I mean, it just sort of naturally changes. And I didn't really, I think for me personally, I didn't really understand the people who wanted to go back home. It's not like, I had a great home life and everything else, but I felt like things had changed for me. I was becoming a different person, and I needed to, in my case, I needed to be in a bigger place. It was, I couldn't really live and work in the suburbs either successfully for one thing, but also just the rich cultural life of a city was something that I felt like I personally needed. And for some people, that's not true. I talk to people out here teaching in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, and they talk about they've only gone to New York City like 3 times in their life, and they're in their 50s or 60s. And that's mind-boggling to me because but that's just a frame of reference. It's like some people don't like the city. Some people don't like being outside of the city. And some people, like me, I like having a balance, a little bit of both as well.
And what was your biggest challenge in writing this piece? We talked a little bit about Chris as kind of an evolving character, but were there any subject issues or other characters that presented, not necessarily negative challenges, but any kind of bumps in getting this piece to where it ended up?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that continue to be a challenge, and that is there's a culminating event in the play that I'm still playing around with, that how do we, classic playwriting issues, do we get there in a way that makes sense with the overall conflict of the play, and then is that ultimate event and the ramifications of that event meaningful enough in a way that makes sense, is plausible, and aligns with and or challenges audience expectations of, I don't know, the ramifications of that as well. So I'm still playing around with that and still seeing, for example, I think there's a couple of scenes that are missing right now between characters. They never interact, and I think we're missing some ingredients because of that. These characters, the character of Sam and Kevin, don't really have a sustained interaction. And Lizzie and Emma do not have a sustained interaction. And I think I'm interested to know what we might learn if we see them in conversation.
Your comment about kind of the culminating events at the end of the play kind of reminded me of another question I had for you. And not to give away what happens at the end of the play, but backtracking to what leads up to it, can we talk for a moment about the moment that the character arrives that kind of shifts the balance from this being a total drama to being lighthearted and comedic?
Oh, sure, yeah.
It's been a little bit since I've read the play. Can you refresh me on the character's name? Is it Lizzie?
Lizzie, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Where the hell did Lizzie come from? Because that was our question about her, and it was in no way a negative comment. We were steamrolling through this piece, and we were really feeling it. And then Lizzie showed up, and for her first, I would say, 2 sentences, there was kind of an element of, who is this character and how does she fit into the world? And by about the third thing she said, I think we had half of our answer.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, she's definitely an important character in terms of the way that we have some levity in the play, and that's allowed and encouraged. And the other part of that is, for me, just thinking about the people in the world of this play, and their relationship to home, and there's some questions about a relationship to education, and that education isn't only college. That's not the only way you can be educated. And I think that that's one of those difficulties of coming home, of those who leave home and those who stay, and whether they are doing that by choice or whether or not they feel like they have no choice. And Lizzie is one of the characters that I thought is a little bit of a mix between the two. She's staying for a reason, but she's also thinking about leaving, but on her own terms. And so in thinking about that as a happy medium, then I started inventing Lizzie and what might help her get out on her terms.
And have you ever met or worked with a Lizzie? Because I think we all have some shades of that person in our life.
Yeah, especially I think it's interesting. I think part of the humor is when people are they see themselves as a performer, but maybe have never trained or have gotten any critical feedback about whether or not they are successful as a performer, but very eager to be a serious, artful performer. So yeah, I've definitely met a few Lizzies, that's for sure.
You know, and not to put down anybody's art, because everybody's art is relevant and, you know, necessary, but I definitely know some Lizzies in my life who would be in a different position now if someone earlier had said, hey, here's my feedback for you.
Sure. And I definitely also, just on a personal level, I'm like, I've made some art like Lizzie that I thought was very important and amazing and really maybe wasn't. Maybe it was a little too on the nose. It didn't really have complexity. It was a little straightforward. So that's what she seems to work on. She's high in earnestness and she gets lower marks for complexity.
One thing, again, we all have, every artist has to have that project that until the end, even the best artist in the world is always going to have that one little blight where you get to the end and you're like, what did you think? And your best friend will not put you down, but give you an honest answer that kind of makes you look at it and go, oh, yeah, no, okay, I see what you're saying, and let's move on and never talk about this again.
Yeah.
So in terms of the workshop process for this play, I know that just working with you in the past, I know that you're no stranger to workshops, but what was it like working with Elephant Room Productions in this kind of less formal workshop setting?
Well, I've done a variety, I've done just about everything from sitting in the living room, reading the play, to on your feet workshopping. So, I don't know. I feel like there's different scales just give you a different opportunity to listen in different ways. And certainly not being in the room is one way of kind of taking your ego out of it as well. Because I think one of my challenges sometimes in hearing a play for the first time is sometimes it can be very difficult to listen and really hear because I'm nervous, because I'm like concerned that it's not really a play or whatever it might be. So so it's nice to have an informal, you know, or roughly sort of informal setting when there's less pressure and more, I don't know, collegiality and just enjoyment of reading the play.
So what were you hoping to get from the feedback from this type of workshop process?
I think some of the usual suspects of just what is having an impact on folks, both in their reading of what are those things, like we're saying with Lizzie, what are those things that make folks laugh? What are the things that make people think or and feel on things? Are those being effective? And then what are the areas that are confusing and or mysterious in the wrong ways, where there's not enough information to figure it out.
And has this piece evolved at all since working with us? Was our feedback helpful in getting it to a different point?
Yeah, definitely. I keep taking, you know, various individual notes from folks. I brought it into my script writing class as an example of a play that's in progress and got feedback from their point of view. So it's like fellow theater practitioners, you know, both, you know, in Philadelphia and Texas with the company I work with in Texas, and a student perspective have all really been adding to whatever this next revision process is going to be.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for submitting it to us. I personally had a wonderful time reading it, and I would love to see where it goes in the future.
Yeah, me too.
And before we go, I always wrap up the episode with this question, just to bring it back to more conversation and levity. What's your favorite actor, playwright, and play?
My favorite actor these days is definitely Mark Rylance. He's such a phenomenal presence on stage. He's somebody who really lives, I feel like, three-dimensionally in a character, and it makes it look like it's not hard work, which is pretty amazing.
Not an easy feat.
I think one of my perennial favorite plays is Hamlet, just because I keep going back and investigating it, and I'm interested in it as a play, and I'm interested in its endurance as a play as well. Like, I'm interested in why we're interested in it. And in terms of playwrights, I certainly have a lot of playwrights that I'm interested in, and right now I'm exploring Eugene O'Neill a lot, and particularly in the way that his life influenced his work and the way that his work influenced theater, and very specifically influenced our sense of realism in acting, and because I'm bringing that into my intermediate acting class in the spring. So those are the ones on my mind these days anyway.
Half the reason I ask these questions is always to bring a little bit of theater and personality to the podcast, but also in the back of my mind, I love that I have this growing mental bookshelf of plays that I need to check out.
Sure.
Well, thank you again. And for all of our listeners, I would like to assure you that not going to break with the tradition of this podcast, but the cat that has interrupted every episode of the podcast so far has been hanging out this whole time. I've decided to stop trying to prevent him from being a co-host, because he clearly wants to be. So fortunately, he has not interrupted the recording this time, but as long as I have him in this house, I feel like he's going to be a special silent guest on these podcasts.
Great.
Well, David, thank you again so, so much for coming on and talking with me today. And remember, for any other playwrights out there who would like to come on, or who would like to have your work evaluated and heard and have feedback given on it, please send us your play at erpsubmissions@gmail.com. Remember, every story deserves to be heard, so let your story be heard with us. David, thank you again for coming on. Have a great day.
Hey, thank you.
And to all my listeners, I will see you next time.